Hi, welcome to this week's program. By now you've heard that in some places in the world, interest rates have turned negative. When interest rates are negative, it means you can borrow money and receive interest payments from the bank instead of paying interest. Now, I know it sounds crazy, and it is crazy, and it's a crazy messed up thing. But now, because of COVID-19, something crazier just happened. It's called negative oil prices. That's right, the price of oil went below $0. Essentially, it means that a seller of oil, like the U.S., Chevron, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and others, could actually pay the buyer to take possession of the oil. It's like filling up your tank at the gas station and getting paid to do it. Crazy. How could this happen? Well, it seems the world is running out of places to store all the excess oil that continues to build up. The excess continues to rise because production has remained strong just at the time demand has fallen off a cliff. All the storage tankers are filling up, all of the ships with tanks to hold oil are filling up, and even though Russia and Saudi Arabia have come to an agreement to start reducing their output in May, demand is so incredibly weak right now that it has created a whopping excess. It's another example of the unexpected effects brought on by an unprecedented viral calamity. One trader writing in Forbes magazine blamed the sharp drop on an exchange-traded fund with the symbol USO. It holds oil futures in its portfolio, and his reasoning had to do with an anomaly in the way the monthly contracts traded. So oil has become incredibly volatile, just like the stock market. In early March, oil prices had fallen 75% since the beginning of the year, and as I just mentioned, even went negative for a brief period of time. Last Thursday, though, oil rebounded by 20%, but it really did little to erase the losses since the beginning of the year. So the two most important issues going forward will be the reduction in production in an attempt to balance the supply with demand, and also to see demand rise to meet the supply. Both are very far apart right now, and it will take dramatic cuts in production to bring them in line. There is movement, however, because according to some reports, we are starting to see major cutbacks in production right now. Let's keep an eye on this one. Another theme I want to examine today is the question of dividends. You know, dividends are a very important source of income for investors and also represent a good percentage of the stock market's historic rate of return. As companies experience significantly lower profits, though, the portion of those profits which come to us as dividends may be affected. Now, it makes sense that companies losing billions of dollars are going to drastically reduce, suspend, or eliminate their dividends. And that's exactly what is happening in some industries. Some companies that have already suspended dividend payments are Ford, Delta, Carnival Cruise Lines, Las Vegas Sands, Marriott, Macy's, just to name a few. According to Goldman Sachs, the money paid to shareholders as dividends will likely be reduced by 25% in 2020, and that's an average of the S&P 500. So which industries do you think will cut their dividends? Well, energy, you know, for one, with oil currently at $20 a barrel. Entertainment, which, with the exception of streaming, has basically disappeared. Travel, there is none. Restaurants, all closed. And retailers with stores? I don't have to explain that. But choosing those were pretty obvious. We can see that all around us. But what about bank stocks with the possibility of tons of bad loans? How about real estate with people deferring their rent or working from home? You know, will they ever go back to their offices? Nursing home stocks with coronavirus protection issues. Will each of these challenged entities pass through their suffering by lowering their dividends to shareholders? Well, the answer lies in details, my dear. Some will and some won't. The key will be to figure out which companies within those industries are in good financial shape and which are not. Goldman's report lists about 40 stocks from 10 industry sectors they believe will be able to maintain their dividends. Out of the 40, 13 are financial companies, 7 industrials, 5 are utilities, 3 are from real estate, 3 are from healthcare, 3 from info technology, 2 from consumer staples, and 1 from communication services. Let's take a look at one of the companies on Goldman's list. It's a major money center bank, you know, of the two big to fail variety. It was down 41% year to date as of March 30th, and it still really hasn't come back all that much. It has $11 of assets for every $100 of liability, which doesn't sound like much, but in the banking business, a ratio of 1 to 10 is considered to be sound banking. It pays 47% of its earnings as a dividend, and if their earnings get walloped by 33%, the payout ratio would jump from 41% to 71%, still leaving ample room for more negative surprises. Now here's an interesting kicker. The current annual dividend yield is around 7%. Now generally, it's not a good idea to be sniffing around companies just because they have a high dividend rate. Often it's a sign that the steep reduction in the share price is predicting some invisible problem. So comparing that low price to a dividend that was paid out over the last 12 months could be a big mistake. It could mean the market thinks there's a dividend cut coming. Well, maybe the market thinks so with this big bank. But after Goldman ran the numbers, it doesn't think so. Of course, Goldman can be and is often wrong in its predictions, so caveat emptor, please. However, it makes for an interesting situation and a possible opportunity. So the key to this list of Goldman's, or any list you might devise yourself, will be your ability to take a close look at the company you want to buy and treat your decisions seriously. So seriously as if your life depended on it. You want to look at things like whether it has enough cash on hand to weather the storm. Does it have a good rating so it can borrow money at decent rates if things continue to degrade? Are its operations efficient? Does it have stable cash flow? Will their cash flow still cover the dividend in a worst-case scenario? Hey, you know, this is the fun part of investing. Learning what makes a business tick, learning how to value a business so you pick the price that you want to pay. But it also takes plenty of knowledge, both cerebral and emotional. So if you're up to it, great. If not, consider some exchange-traded funds that have created their own list of criteria for buying excellent companies with higher-than-average dividends. There are plenty of them out there. Or, if you want to be even more careful, talk to an advisor. Either way, you may be able to find companies paying north of 4%, which is so much more than fixed income investments, and maybe as an added bonus, you may also enjoy dividend increases when this crisis is finally over. You know, to hear this in any interview again, or if you have a question, we'd love to get your questions. Visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I'm very happy to welcome back Jonathan Clements. He's founder and editor of the Humble Dollar website. He's also author of a fistful of personal finance books, including From Here to Financial Happiness and How to Think About Money. And I asked him to join me today to help us define investment risk and appreciate its true nature. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Now, investment risk is often misunderstood, and it takes times like these to get to the root of it so we can make the right decisions about our money going forward. Now, we know that we've all gotten a taste of what risk feels like over the past few weeks, and it brings up the question of what exactly is risk, how can it be measured, and what should we expect from the outcome of taking more risk? Jonathan?
So let's start with two notions that you hear financial experts discuss, and I think it's a really useful distinction. Financial experts distinguish between risk tolerance and risk capacity. So risk capacity is our objective ability to take risk. So if we have a stable job and we've got decades to retirement, we can objectively take a lot of investment risk. We can put a large percentage of our portfolio in the stock market. The problem is, even if we have a high capacity to take risk, we may have a very low tolerance for risk. And when we're talking about tolerance for risk, it's really a subjective issue here. How much risk can you take before you freak out?
Yeah.
That essentially is risk tolerance. And some people are perfectly happy seeing their stock market investments drop 30, 40%, and other people will lie awake at night worrying about the end of the world.
A lot of decisions about how to place your money are made when times are either benign or good. You see the markets rising, or you generally have this feeling that markets will rise. You also may generally know that, you know, recessions happen, markets go down, and maybe you've ridden one or two of them, so you have a pretty good idea. But when you get into the heat of the battle and markets are down double digits in one day, and it seems like things are just totally chaotic and out of control, your tolerance, your emotional tolerance for risk changes. Now, take us through that change, Jonathan.
So these issues have been pretty thoroughly explored by experts in something called behavioral finance. Behavioral finance looks at the mental mistakes we make both in up markets and in down markets. So when the market is going up, we take those gains, we extrapolate them into the future. We imagine share prices will rise forever. As we make money, we attribute those gains to our own brilliance. We start to think that, wow, we really know what we're doing. Our confidence grows and grows. We start to take ever more risk. And then suddenly a pandemic turns up and share prices start to decline. And all of this goes into rapid reverse. We lose that self-confidence. We're suddenly unsure of what we're doing. We see our portfolio falling in value. We watch the market coming down and we go, oh my goodness, it's going to zero. This nest egg I've built within a few short weeks is going to disappear down a black hole and I'm going to be broke. Most people in that situation simply freeze. They don't buy, they don't sell. They just stick their head in the sand. They don't look at their account statements and they just close their eyes and wait for it to all be over. Mm-hmm. But for some minority of investors, it's just too much. And they commit what is probably the cardinal sin of investing, which is they sell close to the market bottom. They get out, they lock in their losses, and they say goodbye to tens of thousands of dollars that they will never see again.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been saying that there's two things that should be quarantined right now, our bodies and our portfolios. I think it's time to, you know, you put your portfolio into quarantine. That doesn't mean you can't take something out of it and replace it with something else if necessary, of course. But generally speaking, this idea, maybe the freeze, maybe the deer in the headlights effect is a positive for some people. What do you think?
I think you're right, Steve. I mean, we know what good behavior is during a stock market decline. Good behavior is, you know, you try to invest more in the stock market, you rebalance your portfolio, you take tax losses and then take the proceeds and reinvest in other stock market investments. Those are good behavior during a stock market decline. But if you can't get yourself to act well, at least don't act badly. And simply freezing your portfolio and not doing anything isn't the worst way to behave.
Right. You know, a lot of people who have brokerage accounts, whether they be of the discount broker variety, like the Fidelities and the Schwabs, or they be the stockbroker variety, have to fill out risk tolerance questionnaires. Now, I know you have opinions about them. I've been investing for over 40 years as a professional, and I stopped using risk tolerance questionnaires about 25 years ago because I found them, they don't really work. They don't really give you any information. Because of what you just mentioned, the fact that feelings change over time and most people don't really know, they're not really equipped to make the kind of decisions that risk tolerance questionnaires ask. So I just like to go through some of these questions here and get your opinion on them. So first of all, they will ask you, you know, when are you going to need the money? And you may say, well, less than a year or 5 to 10 years. I think that's a pretty valid question. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with you, Steve. I mean, if you have money that you're going to need to spend in the next 5 years, whether it's your emergency money or it's your next 5 years of portfolio withdrawals once you're in retirement, that money should not be in the stock market. It should be in super conservative investments, maybe high-quality short-term bonds, maybe certificates of deposit, maybe a high-yield savings account. You shouldn't be taking any more risk than that. So yeah, that's a perfectly valid question.
And that means that if you're retired and you know you're going to take income from your portfolio, you need to have a good cushion of non-equity investments in order to draw down from when your equity investments are down. This will help you keep your head straight. So that's a good question. No problem with that question. So then it asks, so here's a question that I have some problems with. This is from a Vanguard questionnaire, by the way. From September 2008 through November 2008, stocks lost more than 30% of their value. If I owned a stock investment that lost about 30% of its value in 3 months, I would sell all my remaining investments, sell some of my remaining investments, hold on to the investment, and sell nothing or buy more. Now, what do you think of that question, Jonathan?
Well, Steve, if you asked me, if I was walking by and I noticed the house was burning and that there were people inside I could save, hypothetically, I would run in the door and save them. But if I was actually walking past the house and it was actually on fire, I think I would think twice about running into that burning house.
Yeah.
So similarly, you can ask people hypothetical questions about how they would behave. And of course, they're going to say, yes, I will behave well. But when you put them in that situation, they may not act as well as they might imagine. And that's true for all of us in all kinds of situations. It's just enormously difficult to imagine when we're faced with the reality of a plunging stock market, whether we will sell, sit tight, or buy. Mm-hmm. And until you've lived through some market declines, I don't believe you can honestly say what your true risk tolerance is.
I think that most people are not really that in touch with those kinds of thoughts and feelings to be able to answer questions like that. I think these questionnaires are more for the companies that use them to protect them from legal liability in the future or something of that nature. But in reality, I think they do more harm than good. For example, they'll ask you to pick from a group of allocations, 10% stocks, 90% bonds, all the way through the spectrum to 90% stocks and 10% bonds. And they'll say, you know, on average, the decline in worst cases have been X and the return has been Y, the average return over time. Pick one. And I think that reflecting this idea that it's all so hypothetical, I think that the idea of actually asking even myself to pick one which would be better is misleading. What do you think about that?
I agree with you, Steve. I mean, again, it's partly because it's totally different when you experience it, but also nobody has, in the history of the world, has ever gone to the shopping mall and spent a percentage.
Yeah.
When we go to the shopping mall, we spend dollars. And so it's one thing to say, oh yeah, losing 30%, no problem. Yeah. But when somebody says to you, your $100,000 nest egg is now worth $70,000, that money is gone. It may never come back.
Yeah.
How are you going to feel? Suddenly it becomes a whole lot more real, and maybe you would freak out.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to gauge how we're going to react in any particular situation. And moreover, let's just go to today. It's never just that the stock market is going down. There's always some reason for a big market decline. And today, you know, we're not just fearful because our investment portfolios are worth less. We're fearful because we may be about to lose our job. We are fearful because we or members of our family or our friends may get this horrible disease and end up dying. I mean, there's fear piled on top of fear here.
That's the idea that this fear piling on fear turns into an irrational conflagration in your brain and makes it very difficult to know what to do and to even know who to trust and who to believe. I think that's the big problem. So I guess doing nothing turns out to be, you know, the final decision, but nevertheless, this idea of actually going through it. So What's your final advice for those who have to pick an allocation and then have to live through their decisions when bad things happen? Final words.
I would advise anybody who is new to investing to start by being more conservative than their initial inclination. Because the fact is, until you've lived through a market decline or maybe more than one, you simply don't know how much risk you can tolerate. And you don't want to be in that situation where the market is down 40% and you're bailing out of stocks because you're so panicked. So start conservative, figure out what your risk tolerance is from experience, and then you'll know how to invest.
And remember, you're going to suffer from FOMO, fear of missing out. When the markets go up, you're going to probably kick yourself that you weren't more aggressive, but always remember the other side of the coin. Jonathan Clements, editor of Humble Dollar website, which I really recommend this website. It's great commentary. Jonathan's got a lot of experience as editor and journalist, and you definitely want to follow him on a regular basis. That's the Humble Dollar website. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on.
To hear this and any interview again, or if you have a question, you know we love your questions. Visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. And now for another one of my favorite segments to help bring some joy into your world during these crazy times. So here's something totally different. With so many people out of work right now, I thought this segment with Farnoosh Torabi would be a great one to include. While it's wise to work hard and save money, is denied gratification always necessary? Discover how you can live rich with any amount of money. And now for something completely different. You know, old guys like me, I'm 60 years old. I think we have a tendency to tell our kids and the younger generations to save your money for retirement, give up your current pleasures and defer gratification. And, you know, they look at us cross-eyed, you know, it's all good on paper, but is it actually necessary? You know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know, I don't really give this advice. I believe in living your life while at the same time being sensible about your money. And so does my next guest, finance expert and author of You're So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. I welcome Farnoosh Torabi to the show. Welcome, Farnoosh.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Your contemporaries, those that you speak with and that you've interviewed, and these are people that are also my kids' age, are they going to listen to people like me when it comes to getting advice about money?
Well, I think in the heart of hearts, they know that your advice is solid. They know that their parents only want the best for them and that the older generation is speaking from experience and that it's valid. But at the end of the day, I think contemporaries want to hear from their contemporaries. They much more value the advice from a peer than an uncle or an aunt or a parent. And I think that would probably be true when you look back when you were in your 20s and your 30s. You know, you kind of, you know, shrugged off what mom and dad said, even though we knew it was good advice. It meant more to hear it from a contemporary who was maybe in your own shoes, living through some of the same experiences you were. And so my approach to educating young adults is not to dismiss the traditional ideas and values that I know work and I see have worked, but it's all about how you package the message. It's all about the language that you use. It's all about kind of trying to get to see eye to eye with young adults and to understand that, you know, they're working hard, but they're struggling too. They have student loans. Sure. They have perhaps credit card debt. They're not making enough money. And then on top of everything else, they're young, so they want to go out to eat. They want to hang out with their friends. Yeah. The social life is a big part of the equation, and how to afford that is getting more challenging. So I think to kind of show some sympathy and to kind of talk to them more one-on-one, I think that goes a long way, and I think that's what's more appreciated than what comes from an older parent, which at times just feels like a lecture as opposed to really good advice.
You mentioned the word messages. What are the current media messages that are being transmitted to your generation with regards to saving and spending? What are the pressures that you guys are under?
Well, for me, my message has always been, you know, you want to live beyond your means, but spend within them. In other words, you know, try to still achieve the goals that you want to achieve, whether it's to buy a home, buy a car, go back to school, start a business, start a family. You have to sort of think outside the box. And I think that's the challenge right now, is that for young adults working, a lot of the tried and true ways of achieving goals are falling through the cracks. They're not really working. So, you know, it used to be you would just, you know, take out a loan for college and you would finish college and you would pay off that loan easily and you'd be done with it within 10 years. But now what's happening is the price of college is escalating, student loan debt is escalating, and then the jobs aren't really there to support the debt. So what's happening is that the values and the goals have remained, but the challenge now is how to achieve those very same things that our parents achieved in a way that's economically feasible.
You know, when I was, Farnoosh, when I was growing up, it was okay to spend on your credit card, to live beyond your means. We've seen that kind of come full circle. What is the attitude towards debt these days amongst your contemporaries?
Well, it's a work in progress. I think that a lot of young adults are learning the hard way that you really can't take on a $80,000 student loan, or even, you know, in some cases I hear hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is just a nightmare situation. But unfortunately, a lot of young adults are learning the hard way that there is a point to which it's going to be really hard to pay off debt, no matter how much you earn, and that you really need to take a more measured approach to, you know, the kind of debt that you take on and how much debt you take on. And that's part of my job, is to really educate young adults. I've recently spoke with a young woman who graduated from college with about $40,000 in student loans, and before she was even going to figure out how to pay that off, she was looking at law school. And, you know, I really had to level with her and say, why do you want to go to law school? You know, what's your goal? What's this going to do for you? And how are you going to pay for this? Because it's a big undertaking financially, and I don't want to deter you from pursuing your dreams, but you really need to be practical. And so I think when you're young, you know, you're very idealistic. It's very easy to make bad decisions and uneducated decisions that haunt you for years.
I think you think that things are just going to kind of take care of themselves. And, you know, many times, actually, many times they do. My guest is finance expert and author of You're So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not, Farnoosh Torabi. Let's get to some specifics. You talk about the idea of putting yourself first. This kind of sounds selfish, but why is that the right thing to do?
Because no one cares more about your money than you. And at the end of the month, I find that a lot of people struggle to save. So why not try to save at the beginning of the month? You should prioritize your saving and put yourself first, because, you know, between your friends and between all the pressure that you have to spend money in different ways, that money is going to go away before you even know it. And so I say, you know what, you're already, this is the me generation after all. So this is, again, about packaging the message in a way where that they can relate to it.
Wait a minute, Farnoosh. I thought I was the me generation. You guys
we
are too?
I guess it's a phase, right? We all go through the phase. It's not really a generational thing.
Yeah.
You know, the Gen Y is characterized very much as like this, you know, me, self-centered generation, which I would, you know, argue that it's not. I think that in every generation, there are some people that ruin the image for everybody else. I think that Gen Y is actually a very hardworking generation. They're just, they've been raised in at a different pace. They expect things to happen instantly because you were raised on the internet.
Oh, true.
You know, they don't have the patience level as, you know, their parents, but that's not to say that they're not willing to work hard and, you know, pay their dues.
So you're talking about paying yourself first.
But paying yourself first.
Yeah, what does that do for you? Why is that important?
Because if you really want to adapt a savings behavior, you got to sort of address that at the beginning of the month and think of it as, you know, doing yourself a favor. You work so hard. Why not save some of that money immediately for you? You know, again, because this is a very, you know, sort of me generation, let's use that sort of self-centeredness in a positive way, you know, and say, here's your money, save it first, save it for yourself, because otherwise it's all going to go out the window between your friends socializing and, you know, all this other stuff that you're, all these other expenses that you're racking up.
So are you in favor of creating like little buckets, like, you know, I guess for women, a shoe bucket?
Yes. I think, and we talk about this a lot on my show on Yahoo, on Financially Fit, you know, how to budget, how to save, how to save according to your goals. And I think it's really constructive to compartmentalize your savings. Say, okay, this is my savings for retirement. This is my savings for the weekends when I go out. And with our bank accounts these days, you can create various, you know, different savings accounts within one account, sort of sub-accounts that, you know, you can tap into and manage better that way as opposed to one big pot. And it's a little harder to kind of figure out, okay, how much goes to where. But yeah, certainly, I think it helps you stay organized. It's just another facet of staying organized with your money, which goes a long way in making sure that you're not compromising your other savings in order to pay for other for things that you want.
My guest is Farnoosh Torabi. She's a finance expert and author of Your So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. You know, I often talk about on the show, there's really only two ways to kind of get this thing fixed, and that's either you have to raise the bridge or you lower the water. Raise the bridge is get more income. Lower the water is reduce your expenses. That's how you get the ship or the boat under the bridge. So how do you lower your expenses? How do you compartmentalize your thinking to figure out, I guess, what is necessary and what is unnecessary?
Well, you have to first figure out what's important to you. And that's a conversation that young adults rarely have with themselves. You know, what are my goals? What do I want to do in 5 years? Where do I want to be professionally, personally? So you're going to have to do that soul searching as early on as possible, because it's very easy to get swept up and start, you know, following the pack and not really realizing, well, what's actually important to me? And as soon as you can identify those things that are really important to you, whether it's saying to yourself, I plan to go back to school, or I plan to buy a home, or I want to get married. All of those things carry price tags. And so once you can identify those goals, I feel like you can then work backwards and then look at your expenses and say, okay, this is frivolous, this is necessary, because now you actually have a compass. And along the way, there are a lot of ways to even maintain kind of your lifestyle, but at a discount. So make sure you're calling your creditors and you're calling everywhere that you have an account, your cell phone company, your gym, your, you know, you name it, and just call them and ask them about offering you some wiggle room, your cable company, saying, I need a discount or I need to save money. Because at the end of the day, these companies don't want to lose you. And if it means giving you a break or some breathing room for 6 months, whether it's a 10% discount or $10 off or a freebie, that will help you and that will help them. So you have to kind of negotiate these things.
Well, that's a good message here. My guest is Farnoosh Torabi, finance expert, author of Your So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. A real pleasure to speak with you, Farnoosh. I hope to have you back.
Likewise.
Thank you. Bye-bye. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with over 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. Go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the program, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, life in the time of coronavirus.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, we were talking off air about what you call pending sales, because there's some interesting numbers there. Take us through that.
Sure. So I've been monitoring now. We're going into our sixth week of this, and I've been monitoring it. So the first week they started tracing this was March 19th. And At that time, in Palm Beach County, we had 311 properties go under contract. And the following week, that number dropped a little bit to 297. Then the third week, it dropped even more to 209. But by the fourth week, we see the number starting to rise. It went from 209 to 217. And then last week, it went up to 232. So I'm starting to see a trend and a pattern. And what it's telling me is it's saying, okay, we all freaked out and panicked. Sales slowed down. And now we're in the new norm, if you will. And this is the way it's going to be. So we're seeing the transactions start to pick up.
You know, when I write down these numbers, 311 to 297 to 209, up to 217, up to 232, it looks a little bit like the stock market.
It does.
You know, that big downward swoop.
I'm going to call this the V shape. I'm going to say I see a V in this.
You think you see a V? Well,
yep.
You got a long way to go to get back to 311, though.
Yeah, but I still think it's going to be a V.
Okay. All right.
And not a U.
I'm going to take these numbers, and they're only five numbers, so this is not going to be really statistically
No,
accurate,
we don't have enough data yet.
But I'm going to plot it up against the S&P 500 and see if there's a correlation. Okay. All right. So anything new and different in your world? What are the other agents saying? How is business in general?
You know, I mean, in general, the numbers are down, and we're seeing that some sellers have taken the home off the market. And quite frankly, what we're seeing is more of a pause. We're seeing buyers pausing, sellers pausing. But keep in mind, there's plenty of buyers that need to buy a home and sellers that have to sell a home.
Yeah.
What I'm seeing on the seller side, even though our inventory is already low, it's gotten lower. The sellers that want to sell are adjusting their prices a little bit. And the buyers are seizing that, especially the motivated buyers. So I'm anxious to see what does this look like on the backside. I believe for quite some time, we're still going to see the buyer demand greater than the sellers. So what does that mean? I see that we're still going to stay in a seller's market until we come to a point where there's more sellers than buyers. Can that happen? Sure, it can. Will it happen? At some point, yes, it will, because we know that we can't stay in a seller's market forever. And this is, you know, even though it hasn't been technically declared a recession. So I would think that at some point, this is when we will see it begin to reverse a little bit.
You mentioned the word motivation.
Right.
And I think that's the key driver here, because these people who are motivated to sell, they're going to be willing to drop their price, and buyers that are motivated are going to be willing to kind of work through all the greater difficulties. Those who have listed that aren't as motivated, for example, I have friends in New York State who listed their home, but they've pulled it off the market because they feel that a home listed on the market, you know, for a longer period of time when they're not quite so motivated can be a detraction from the sale. What do you think?
I've had a lot of people express that, but I think we're all going to get a pass on this one. I would say in normal times, yes, you know, people monitor days on market. This is so explanatory that I don't believe that that's going to have an impact.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about how the process of buying and selling homes from your agent's perspective has changed and what has stayed the same. Because I would be thinking that if I were looking to buy a home, I would see this kind of chaotic world out there and figure out, well, how is this ever going to get done? How am I going to see these houses? How am I going to close? So I've asked you to
Sure.
walk this through with me so we can kind of see it in our own minds from the agent's eyes. So I want to start it off. So I know the first step is that you have made these virtual open house videos as a virtual tour. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Correct. So the consumers start their home shopping on the internet, and a lot of the agents have created virtual tours, professional photos. All of that makes a huge difference and impact on whether or not a buyer wants to see the home. So a buyer identifies a home that they want to see. I personally take it a step further when the agent calls and inquires about a particular property. I will then send them my little homemade walking tour of the house, which was, you know, made before all of this began. And it shows in greater detail as if you were with me. I'll show you the closets. I'll give you a really detailed tour of the house. Once the client has seen that homemade video and they still want to see it, then I know that they're serious. We'll take it to the next level. And that would be bring them into the property.
Okay.
So now we are going to take you through the house. We go with protective gear, gloves, masks, and booties if required. You now like the house. We go to contract like we normally would. And then the fun begins. We're going to do a lot more deeper qualifying of the buyer, make sure that we're in constant contact with that lender. There's a lot more requirements right now to obtain finance and make sure that we have weekly conversations with all the parties involved, keep everybody motivated to stay in the deal, and make sure that everybody's doing everything in a timely fashion to get us to the closing table.
Once you're at the closing table, what happens? Or is there a closing table?
Is there a table? Yeah. So no, we don't have a table anymore. They're done remotely. They're done in parking lots. You can come into the office. We don't have buyers and sellers and agents all together anymore.
So the deals get done how? They are shuttled paperwork? Are you a paper shuttler now?
I've become an official carrier of paper, yes. Mm-hmm. Whatever it takes to get it done. And same with the title companies. They'll do what they need to do to get it done. We're now doing remote. There's the capability to do complete remote closings with the right lenders and the right title companies.
The real estate business in the time of coronavirus. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
To hear this and any interview again, or if you have a question, you know we love your questions, visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm very happy to welcome back Dr. Bud Labitin, a physician and investor who has produced books related to value investing as practiced by Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. According to what I saw on Amazon, he's written 23 books, including The Four Filters Invention and Illustrated Valuations, which we have discussed on air. And he always has the kind of grounded insight that is sorely needed in times like this. Hey, Bud, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Steve. Glad to be here.
Good morning. Where am I calling you from today? I know I'm from my new studio in my office. Where are you currently situated?
Steve, I'm actually visiting my mother in Titusville, Florida, and have been sheltering in place down here for about 5 weeks now.
Wow.
Normally, I live in Schererville, Indiana, which is in the northwest corner of Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Strange times, aren't they?
Yes.
So, did I count 23 books on Amazon, including the one that stated that you're running for president?
I believe I have about 9 or 10 books, Steve. Some of those are different versions. There's a large type version, and then 4 of them are audiobooks on audible.com.
Oh, wonderful.
So I think the count is around 9 or 10.
Okay, that's enough. So let's get to the business at hand. You know, this virus has wreaked havoc on the world economy to a point where much of the business world is shut down. So I asked the question that I think is on most investors' mind. Would you say that current stock prices in the U.S. accurately reflect a dire outcome or exactly where we stand in the uncertainty? Or do you think American businesses are on sale right now?
I'd like to break your question into two parts there, Steve. In my view, most of the market prices are still slightly overvalued, but not as overvalued as they were in late January. As far as outcome, it all depends on the rate of return to normalcy, which could be accelerated if we have a viable vaccine, or could be accelerated back if we have good treatments that prevent patients from going into the ICU. Those are the two factors in my view.
So when you're looking at stocks to buy, and we're going to get into some of the screens that you use and how you think, forgetting about the fact, you know, we all tend to look at this market as one thing, but it's actually, it's a conglomeration of many different businesses and many different industries operating on many different factors. When you look at your stocks that you've modeled for so many years, are you seeing particular pockets that look incredibly attractive now?
I saw a couple that I viewed as intelligent speculation a couple of weeks ago when the market had really dipped. I saw Boeing at 100 or below 100 as a bargain at that point, because prior to the coronavirus, Boeing had been selling above $400.
Yeah.
The other one that has kind of attracted my eye was Ford Motor, but Ford Motor has a complicated balance sheet. So in general, I tell folks, you know, be careful, do your homework, and also look at their balance sheets and their long-term debt structure.
Yeah, I want to get into that. And also, I want to say that any stocks mentioned are not recommendations. We're just discussing stocks. You have to do your own research, have your own advisor. Again, let me make that perfectly clear.
Oh, sure.
You mentioned intelligent speculation. That's just not a couple of words put together. That's actually a thing, because you developed this intelligent speculation model from your reading of Ben Graham and Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. And I have the chart out in front of me. I want to go through each one of these so our listeners can understand a disciplined way of thinking about investing. Remember, investing is investing in businesses. It's not just numbers that move up and down in the market or, you know, on the internet, Yahoo Finance page, or wherever you're getting your quotes. There's actual economics behind it. So let me start you off. This is the intelligent speculation model.
Sure.
Number one, understand the economics, supply, and demand of the situation. Explain that for us, please.
This model that I developed is based on the 1946 lectures of Ben Graham to his students. And in that last talk, when he was saying goodbye to his students, he sort of said to them, I know some of you are going to end up on Wall Street, and some of you are going to get the temptation to speculate. And let me just read one sentence to you that kind of summarizes everything, Steve. Ben Graham said, there is a real difference between intelligent and unintelligent speculation, and that the methods of security analysis may often be of value in distinguishing between the two kinds of speculation. So the model was imagined in a way that, what if Graham had lived into the modern Buffett and Munger era and applied the four filters, as well as adding the fifth filter of catalyst and conditions needed for a quicker profitable outcome. So that's how the model came into being. As far as number one, understand the economics of supply and demand of this situation. On that one, we have to really look at the time frame of the individual business that the person is looking at, because over the short term, demand is near zero right now.
Yeah.
And hopefully things will start to pick up steam. And then a person who engages in this, which I don't really promote at this point, because I think most folks should just stay calm in the waters right now, but really have to think about the time frame in which they want to lock up their money. Is it for short-term, medium-term, or long-term value?
Right.
And then the rest of them are fairly understandable. Number two is advantages versus disadvantages. You have to really think about, are there real advantages or are they just imaginary?
The company's competitive advantages?
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And also advantages in the period for which they are speculating. Like right now, everyone can understand that the demand on Amazon is going up because everyone's at home. The demand on Netflix is going up because of everyone's at home watching streaming.
Yeah.
But then you have to be a little bit more realistic down the road, is when everyone returns to work, will that demand still be at this level, or will it be 10 or 20% less?
You know, I think when things get exciting, sometimes nasty, but volatile and aggressive, people tend to extrapolate current conditions far into the future. So for example, if the stock market's going down and you get that feeling in your stomach and you want to bolt, let's say you want to sell everything, it's because you're extrapolating that things are going to go to zero or they're just going to keep going down. And of course, they never do. On the flip side of that, when things are exciting and prices are going up and you're feeling like you're really a genius because somehow you're making all this money and you have some role in that, people tend to extrapolate into infinity the earnings of some companies like an Amazon or otherwise. So psychology plays an important role in this, right?
Right. I agree. Psychology and careful thinking. I think the number one thing is think about safety, think about defining reality. And if you do those two things or the three things we talked about, people will make better decisions if they put more thought into them.
Talking about putting more thought into what you do, if you're going to take an approach of investing in individual stocks, I think there are methodologies and disciplines that one should use. And one of the most common types is setting up a stock screen. This is where you can actually go online or get a piece of software or use an app where you can ask or put in certain conditions of what kind of balance sheet a company should have, what type of net profit margin, and so on. And you've done that, and you do that all the time. And I want to go over one of the templates that you're using, the stock tracking template, I think you call it.
Sure.
So what I really liked about this was that when it all came out in the wash, you would rate a particular company in three ways. Is this a wife? Is this a girlfriend? Or is this a one-night stand? And I got a kick out of that. Because at first, when I looked at that, I was like, what are you talking about? you're asking your opinions of your wife, your girlfriend about, what you should be investing in. But seriously, what you're really saying is what?
What I'm saying is, if you were really digging into it and thinking about it, a wife would be someone you want to be with forever. And thus, you're looking for a company that has characteristics of endurance and profitability and superior qualities.
Okay.
As far as the girlfriend has some attractive qualities and applied to a business or a stock, you would put that category on your watch list because there might be opportunities where the business is selling at a significant bargain and you may want to buy it and hold it for a year or two. And then finally, the one night stand is the speculation where you see a bargain and it meets the criteria on the ideal business speculation model. There is a catalyst and you have a high confidence or probability that the catalyst will kick in. So it's a speculation. It's a short-term speculation and you have to set upper limits and lower limits on your speculation. So you have to be more careful about those.
All right. So let's take a look at some of the companies. I think the first criteria that you're using, and I think it's incredibly important to use that today, is the amount of debt that a company has relative to their equity or relative to their assets. Because if business is going to slow down and for a protracted period, these companies need to be able to survive. So they need a decent balance sheet. They'll need cash on the balance sheet. They'll need access to borrowings if necessary. So their relative debt to their structure has to be pretty reasonable. So I noticed that was in the first column. What kind of filter are you using to debt to assets here, Bud?
This is simply taken from a program that I wrote called Stocks Calc, and it gets data from multiple online sources. I think one of the examples I mentioned here is Apple has a long-term debt to asset ratio of 0.27. So that means 27% of assets, or relative to the assets, 27% are in long-term debt.
That's pretty low.
Yeah, it's pretty low. Mm-hmm. And some companies have a lot higher. I believe Ford's is around 0.47. So If you compare those two, Apple has a lesser proportion of debt to assets.
I was surprised to see on this list that ExxonMobil, which is in a really terrible industry right now. We've just saw oil prices plummet once again. they only have 7% of debt to assets. So this is a company that just on this one metric, and don't trade on this metric, folks, but it seems like a fairly strong possibility that they should be able to get through this based on this one metric.
I agree, Steve. ExxonMobil has a lot of oil in the ground, and they have control of numerous large oil fields across the world. So you know they're going to ride through this difficult period. It's just a matter of when prices return to near normalcy.
Yeah. You know, we're unfortunately running out of time. This went really quickly. So I'm just going to quickly mention some of the other criteria.
Sure.
The net profit margin, the estimated intrinsic value. Now, intrinsic value is something that is kind of it's a floating figure, and there's numerous ways to calculate intrinsic value, but one way is the discounted cash flow model. And so I think you use that in your filters?
Yes. For your listeners, I mentioned that my model in several of my books, and briefly, it's just taking an approach on the free cash flow, growing it out at a conservative growth rate for 10 years,
right,
flattening it from year 10 to 15, summing that all up, and then using the net present value method to get the present value of that amount of money and then dividing by the number of shares outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're limited for time, but it is mentioned in several of my books.
So actually, I invite my listeners to go on to Amazon and take a look at those books. And if you're interested in this, to purchase some of them. My guest is Dr. Bud Labitan, Labitan, a physician and investor. And he's, as I mentioned, he's produced these books. And as a devotee of the Buffett Graham Munger school, uses these metrics to measure investment quality, especially in times like this, where you don't want to be stuck with companies that can go out of business and get into serious financial trouble. You really want to go with those that are tried and true and safe. Bud, thank you so much for joining me once again.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve.
To hear this and any interview again, or if you have a question, you know we love your questions, visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.